This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. This is Dr. Jonathan Abel, and I'm here with Dr. Bill Nance.
Hello.
And today we're going to talk with Colonel Dr. Nate Jennings.
Hello.
Who is from the DeJamo Department here at CGSC. And one of his many areas of specialty is the 1973 war. And before we get started, a note for listeners. There are many different names for this war. You'll often see it called the Yom Kippur War, which of course is from the perspective of Israel. You'll sometimes see it called the Ramadan War, which is kind of the perspective of the various Arab states involved in it. The preferred is now just the 1973 War, the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, because that doesn't particularly weight either side of it. But like I said, you will see lots of different names for it. So Colonel Jennings, let's kind of start at the beginning. This is not the first war between a coalition of Arab states and Israel. So what's the background of this conflict before we kind of get into the early 70s?
Yeah, so thanks for having me on. Great to be with you guys again. So the background of 73 is a story of increasing Israeli military dominance in the region. Since 48, 49, fighting for independence. In the Suez War, it's actually an Israeli breakout victory in the Sinai. They're forced to pull back. And then 67 is when they really put their stamp on the arena. Using fast-moving armored columns, dominating air support, air interdiction, mostly air interdiction, beginning with a decapitation strike against several Arab air forces, they meet and defeat all comers in the region. So they defeat Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and they do it decisively in sequence. And dramatically expand the state of Israel afterwards when they occupy the Sinai Peninsula, the West Bank, Golan Heights, and Gaza.
And East Jerusalem as well.
That's right.
Yeah. So we've got a situation in which Israel, a relatively newly created country, is surrounded by people who at best don't like it and at worst don't want it to exist. On the other hand, the Arab states don't particularly like Israel, but what does each of them want? What does Syria want? What does Jordan want? What does Egypt want?
By 73, it's about pride and territory. They're the same thing. They want their ground back. You have Israeli army overlooking the Suez Canal, and it's an insult every day that their flags are flying. Same thing in the Golan Heights. Israel seizes that ground, sets up a defensive posture, refuses to give it back. Same thing with the West Bank. And so this is about Arab honor. It's about restoring what they probably would see as the natural order of things in that area.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's not just honor, though, because let's talk about like the significance, strategic significance of the Golan Heights, mm-hmm. of the West Bank, of the Sinai, because those are not just places, but they're significant places strategically. Could you kind of talk us through what those are in turn?
Yeah, for Israel, from their perspective, this is strategic depth. They're a small country, vastly outnumbered cumulatively by the Arabs' competitors that surround them. Egypt alone far outnumbers them. And so this depth gives them reaction time, gives them the ability to trigger their rapid mobilization, which is essential for any victory to happen. And so to them, this is survival. And they're unwilling to give it back absent some paradigm shift in a recognition of the Israeli state.
And the Golan Heights, of course, being the only significant defensible terrain between Damascus and the sea.
That's right. So protecting Tel Aviv, the northern Israeli cities, it's essential. It gives them that depth, that defensive position.
Mm-hmm. And it's worth mentioning as well, there is a religion aspect here, but we're not going to get into it because that's contentious and it causes people to get mad at each other. So we're talking more of the political, social, military aspect of it. And there is also, I think it's worth mentioning too, this is still the era of pan-Arabism. So it's not just about nations. There's a kind of a broader pan-Arabism led by Egypt that's seeking to restore an Arab state in the Levant.
That's right. Nasser had really taken a leading role in that. Then he loses badly in 67. Sadat is kind of picking that up. And kind of ironically, the guys really tying it together are the Soviets.
Well, Moscow is playing
a big role here in as the benefactor, as the coordinator between many of these disparate and sometimes competing Arab states.
This is where I wanted to go next in the big picture. Of course, this happens during the Cold War. Yeah. And it's tempting to view every conflict during this period as a Cold War proxy, but there is an element of that here. So how do the Cold War powers play into the region and into the conflict?
Well, it's just like every other continent, the Middle East is a competitive arena for the U.S., for the Soviets to stake out allies and clients and influence. And for the Soviets, they've pretty much armed the Egyptians and the Syrians to the teeth. And so it becomes also a thing where their guy can't lose. Mm-hmm. Their equipment set can't be seen to be inferior. And so that's why the Russians will get involved in a big way at the end when it looks like the Egyptians in particular could potentially suffer total defeat.
Okay, so from the American perspective, America has not always been terribly friendly towards Israel, particularly in the early decades, but after 1960 it has, but America is also distracted by Vietnam. So how does that play?
So right now Kissinger, he's preoccupied with Vietnam. Nixon is occupied with other things. And as well, there's actually a little bit of a detente going on with the Russians, and nobody wants to mess that up at this time. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a weird, not a pause in the Cold War, but a little bit of a warming. And so Sadat, Golda Meir, they're all kind of uncertain how to play this with their benefactors as the war, 73 war, kicks off.
Mm-hmm. So let's drill down into some of the details of the planning. As you mentioned, the Israelis have a system where they rely on usually preemptive air power, mm-hmm. deep air strikes, followed by often unsupported armor pushes very mm-hmm. quickly through enemy formations. How does Israel go from, the joke saying is the guy working at the falafel stand to that? How do you mobilize a country quickly when you're surrounded by enemies?
Well, in some ways, it's not that hard because it's a small country. So the movement to, staging grounds, not that far. From staging ground to the front doesn't take too much time compared to maybe a larger, the U.S., for example, Russia, larger countries. So they have space, actually. While it's a disadvantage as far as maintaining distant frontiers, it is an advantage for mobilization. And they just, this is existential. Everyone's on board. And so one of the things by the Egyptians and the Syrians attacking on Yom Kippur, it does catch them off guard on a holiday. At the same time, everyone's, most of the citizenry is gathered together for their religious celebration. And so in that sense, mobilization really picks up quickly.
So what role does intelligence play on the Israeli side, being able to gather intelligence about an attack that is coming?
Yeah, intelligence is so one of the big three Israeli pillars. We mentioned the armor. So they have the best armored corps in the Middle East. They have this Tier 1 Air Force, which is really the backbone of their military. It's the reason they have such an advantageous posture. And then the third is the intelligence. Mm-hmm. Mossad really has a high reputation. Again, this is about this is existential, so you're going to put a lot of resources there, and they're going to have an epic kind of miss here, particularly with the Egyptian offensive.
So let's talk force structure very briefly, because you talked about, Dr. Abel mentioned unsupported armor attacks. So The Israelis in 1967, the kind of story is these deep armored thrusts, which is basically a series of tanks. And these aren't necessarily even all that great tanks. In many cases, these are cast off Shermans.
Super Shermans.
that are rolling around. So how are the Israelis able to pull off these deep armored thrusts with relatively crappy tanks and using their air force to do that? What kind of force structure do they build and why?
Well, I mean, they have armor brigades, armor divisions, and by 73, what you're really looking at is really about seven armor divisions. But again, they take the wrong lessons, right? They begin the 73 war with these relatively pure tank divisions. They have some combined arms approach, but it's a pretty narrow approach. The Israeli divisions that cross the canal, a couple weeks later into the war, very combined arms. They're rounded out with a lot of infantry, self-propelled artillery. So they have to relearn that lesson in stride.
So let's make sure we understand what the difference is. And both of you are Colonel Jennings, you're in uniform. Dr. Nance, you have been in uniform. Why is it a problem to have these obsolete tank units operating basically just as armor with air support, as opposed to a combined arms approach?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I'd say they're obsolete. They have tier one tanks by 73. They have 48 M48s, M60s, variants of an Israeli version. They have some pretty good Centurions. But the problem is that combined arms warfare is a chess game. Each piece has advantages, disadvantages, and they don't have the ability to apply those asymmetries. So, for example, they counterattack straight into the canal. They should easily push the Egyptian attackers back into the water, make them retreat in disarray with their powerful tank attack. And they just run into infantry with these SAGR missiles, RPG-7 teams. And it's a nightmare because they have, what they need is infantry on the ground to clear them out. They need artillery to suppress. You know, anti-tank crews are not that hard to deal with if you have a lot of artillery.
Mm-hmm. And to take this a step further, the interesting thing is, like, because you're exactly right with combined arms, but the Israelis are a small manpower poor country, very small population. Infantry divisions are exceptionally manpower dense. So if you can win the high technology way with the equipment, so you put three or four guys in a tank, actually some tanks of that era had five even. Mm-hmm. That's still cheaper manpower-wise than an infantry platoon,
right?
Which is about the equivalent in terms of firepower. Mm-hmm. So what you see is that you can see why the Israelis did that, because if I've got to mobilize some, if I've got to keep something on active duty, it's cheaper to keep a tank crew than an infantry platoon. It's fewer people. That means I can have more civilians doing business things as we go through there. Same thing with aircraft.
And that comports with their strategic problem. They're the Germans of the Middle East in the sense that they're surrounded, they're mm-hmm. smaller, they have to win quickly and decisively, end the war on their terms, and armor's the way to do that.
Dr. Jones, you brought up something else that I want to kind of tug on, because you kind of mentioned it as almost on the aside, which is RPG teams, mm-hmm. And also anti-tank guided missile, what we call ATGMs. Yeah. The most famous from this era is the SAGR, uh-huh. or if you're on the American side of things, the TOW, tube launched optically wire guided missile.
Yeah,
just called the TOW, but TOW as opposed to the big TOW. But the difference being is, like, did this technology exist in the Middle East? Because it existed in Russia or the Soviet Union in the United States, but was this technology widely fielded in the Middle East in 67, and how is that different from 73?
No, it wasn't. And so that's one of the game changers. The Egyptians basically lose their whole equipment set, and they just buy a new one from the Russians, and with that new equipment set comes the standoff weaponry, both to counter tanks and aircraft.
Well, let's drill down on that too, because we now have the Israeli picture, right? We know how the Israelis are going to operate, and more importantly, so do the Arab states. So if you're an Arab state and you've been smashed in the previous war, you know what the Israelis are going to do, you know how they operate. You mentioned the big three, intelligence, air, tanks. How do you counter that? How do you, as we say in PME, how do you get inside the Israeli OODA loop?
So from the Egyptian side, they create a purpose-built army designed to do one thing, cross the canal with speed and mass and set up a very limited defense using just those advantages, standoff fires, both in the air and against tanks, and it's not designed to do anything else. And we know that because when they try to do something else, they take a severe beating. So that's what, you know, these are smart thinking actors here. Shazly, who's the Egyptian chief of the general staff, really smart guy. He goes to school on the Israeli way of war and figures out how to develop an asymmetric counter to it. Mm-hmm. And the Israelis fall right into it.
So let me ask both of you again, as practitioners, if you are an Israeli tank commander and the enemy has built a force designed to do basically a bite and hold, and they send out these anti-tank teams, you know, it's basically a few guys with an anti-tank weapon, what kind of problems does that pose for you?
So part of it is cognitive. The Israelis think so low of the Egyptian soldier. It doesn't really matter if they have that plan or not. They'll be overrun. They'll run away. They'll collapse. And so they're just so surprised that these Arab soldiers they're more disciplined. They're more aggressive. They have more courage. And they stand their ground. As tanks are charging them, these infantrymen set up their saggers and they go to work. For some numbers, the IDF will lose 500 tanks in the first week between both fronts, about 50 tier one attack aircraft, and this puts them back on their heels. Because again, small state, they don't have a lot of reserves coming up once the mobilization is complete. They're not like the U.S. that can just have 100 divisions mobilize. And so they have to win with what they have.
Mm-hmm. And to take that a step further is the SAGR, which is it's a guided missile. It works where you fire it, and it's got a wire that spools out behind it. You steer it basically like a joystick, where you've got the optics, but sometimes you can just guide it by sight. Mm-hmm. It's not a particularly fast missile, and it's a very accurate missile. It also has a range that exceeds the max effective range of the Israelis' tanks' main guns. Mm-hmm. So what you do is that you have these soldiers that have been won, more effort has gone into training them.
Yep.
So they're able to do that. And then they see the Israeli tanks at range, and then Israeli tanks start dying at range. That then motivates them to work even harder. Now, again, the Israelis don't buy a lot of self-propelled artillery. Reason being is artillery is expensive. Artillery is also it's less manpower intensive than infantry, but it's still more manpower intensive than a tank. Also, if I've got the Air Force overhead and flying artillery, I don't need to buy that. Again, you're a small country, you can only afford some things. Mm-hmm. So the number one way to kill a SAGR team is with an artillery thing, because the guy's got to steer the missile the whole way. It makes a nice big signature. You can see the missile coming at you.
So let's drive down this road. Let's say you're Captain Nance, and you have no reactive armor, right? No real satellite intel like you might today. So you're Captain Nance in a tank in 1973, and you see SAGRs, you know, I guess flying by you. What do you do, Captain Nance, if you're an American?
We do what's called the SAGR drill, which is the very first thing you do is you see the signature, you pop smoke. You got the tank has smoke grenade launchers, you launch those. That's going to obscure the target. At that point, the guy knows where you were, but not he has to steer it onto the target. You're then going to start driving radically weird. You're going to start moving around all over the place. Also, what you want to do is you want to put a round as close as possible in that guy's direction. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with those missiles is there's a range imbalance. Now, bearing in mind, the farther the range, the less accurate everyone is. So if you, because again, I don't have to hit the guy. I just have to scare him enough that the missile goes sideways. But then this gets to the other piece that we need to talk about and give the Egyptians some credit, which is the missile, so the SAGRs are killing guys at range because the Israelis are not used to this. Mm-hmm. They're not used to being engaged at 3,000 plus meters.
So they probably haven't trained on it.
They've not trained on this. They don't have the right equipment. They don't have the right muscle memory, because this is something you've got to do, because, okay, 3,000 meters, that's a slow missile, but a slow missile, it's still a missile, right?
Right.
So you've got about a couple seconds to react, but only a couple seconds. The other thing is, as you get closer, the RPGs that Dr. Jennings mentioned, those have a max effective range of 200 to 300 meters, and let's be honest, about 150 meters. Because at that point, it's not guided. You're putting a rocket up on your shoulder and you're pulling the trigger. It takes a pretty steady person to do that against a tank. But if I'm seeing them die at range, I now have more confidence that I can stay there and fight that. Now, again, the way to do that is I've got infantry to go and chew these guys up, because typically what they do is they let me drive past, and then they'll stick up from their hole and shoot me in the butt. Mm-hmm. But that requires them to have the guts to do that and not be afraid of an infantryman coming behind them to stick him in the, with a bayonet.
So in an American force in the 70s, an American conventional force as opposed to the one fighting in Vietnam, you wouldn't just be in your tank, correct? You would have combined arms forces around you.
Yeah, and we actually know how this looks, because the Israelis figure it out in the third week. The tanks will make contact, go into kind of a hold down position, and then you send in dismounted infantry to flank and start rooting these guys out of their positions, these SAGR teams. You suppress with artillery at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a relatively simple problem to solve if the SAGR teams are unsupported.
If you know it's there, correct?
If you know it's there, but maybe you lose one tank in the first salvo. But once you know they're there, they have to be in the open to do their to aim it, continuous wire guided. And, you know, they're vulnerable to a combined arms approach.
So let's talk about the other two pillars. You mentioned that the Israelis in particular at the beginning will try to substitute air for combined arms, or certainly for artillery.
To an extent, yeah.
So how are the Arab states, in particular the Egyptians, countering that pillar of the Israeli?
Well, they, again, right off the shelf, they buy a suite of surface-to-air missile systems, each designed to strike at different altitudes, plus anti-aircraft artillery, the famous ZSU-23-4 that everybody loves. And so they're just going to make a non-permissive contested airspace. Mm-hmm. And the IAF has a plan to deal with this. They know it's there. They've been, something called the war of attrition happens before. It's a simmering fight that's been happening over the Sinai and over kind of the canal for the previous 3 years. So the IAF knows that they have this stuff. Not all of it. Some of the equipment comes in right at the end. But they have a plan to disintegrate it, to reduce it methodically. Mm-hmm. The problem is, when the Egyptians come across the canal, they're no longer allowed to do that methodical plan. They're told, go kill the Egyptian bridges, support the armor, and so they have to fly right into these kind of the ranges of these missile systems.
So basically, if I'm understanding correctly, their plan was kind of strategic operational air power, and they were then tasked with doing an operational tactical series of tasks.
Yeah, a lot of that. And as well, deprived for political reasons of doing a decapitation strike, mm-hmm. a preemptive strike, because the Americans say, don't do it. Mm-hmm. We need you to have some moral high ground here. So that's a lesson I talk to students about, that the policymaker will place you in a disadvantageous position militarily, and you'll just have to deal with it.
And diplomacy trumps military.
Yep. And as you fight into an anti-access environment, you can almost view it like a medieval siege or an early modern siege, which is, you don't go herring off straight up against their main forces. What you start doing is you start picking off the outer edges, which what that will do over time is that will create gaps that you can then slide into and pick more of the
So for example, part. The way they deal with it in Syria, they lose an enormous amount of F-4 Phantoms, planes like that, in the first day in Syria. But then they figure out, if they do an indirect approach, they start flying through Jordan, coming up on the flank where the SAMs, remember, it's integrated air defense systems. It's not just a launcher. There's radars, there's C2, there's logistics. All of that is a system working together. It's kind of oriented towards the Golan Heights, and they come up from the flank and begin to take it apart very quickly.
So let me ask you again, as practitioners, we Americans are spoiled in that we have achieved air superiority or dominance in our recent conflicts pretty easily. It's basically been since early Vietnam that we had any real contest in the air. So first of all, what does it do for you, ground soldier, to have the air support?
It allows you to maneuver. So again, something I talk about with my students is decisive maneuver possible against a peer enemy without air superiority. Mm-hmm. In almost all the cases where you got some kind of breakout, some kind of sweeping decisive maneuver, the side doing it has the skies and can apply interdiction in depth.
So let's for both of you, but particularly for you, Colonel Nance, you're again Captain Nance, you're in your tank, and you have lost your air cover. What does that mean to you?
Well, and here's the thing is that it depends on what else you have. Again, United States, rich country. We can have all the toys. As long if I've lost my air cover, but the enemy doesn't have his, mm-hmm. I've lost an asset in my arsenal, which is going to make my life harder. I do not have the deep strikes to disintegrate his artillery, to take out his command and control, but I still have my artillery. I can still call on a battery, 155s, or all the. I can call on artillery, additional assets, which I can then use to apply some measure. I have lost a tool in my arsenal, and the United States is very heavily dependent upon air power, more so as we've pulled more and more artillery out of the order of battle. But we still have it. This is the problem the Israelis had on the opening days, is that
they have
the
one screwdriver.
They have the tool.
Yep.
And if somebody has got, they're using a rock, and that works so long as the other side's using scissors. But the instant they pull out the paper,
right.
Now you've lost, all you have is your tank and whoever else you can pull up.
And this is the chess game, because on October 14th, due to political mandates, the Egyptian army goes on the offense again, mm-hmm. attacks into the central Sinai, and is decimated because they have to leave behind their air cover. Mm-hmm. And they're exposed, and basically it's a textbook gunnery situation, engagement area development, and they lose 260 tanks in like maybe 2 or 3 hours.
Well, let's talk about another analogy, because Dr. Nance, one of the many things you do is World War II, which is the last war in which you had very large countries with very large true peer air forces fighting each other. So why was it so important for the Allies, particularly the Soviets, to clear out the German air before they could launch their really large offensives?
Well, I mean, air does lots of things for you, right? So first off, let's start with the basics. It's reconnaissance. I can fly over something, I can see it on the ground, it's there, which then allows me to do any number of things. I can move reserves, I can put air strikes against concentrations before you even cross the line of departure. So I can start shaping the battlefield just by the fact that I have now extended the battlefield from two mm-hmm. dudes looking at each other to deep end. The other piece that you want to take a look at is that as you start to engage on the battlefield, now I can start doing things as I can hit your command post. And I'm talking tactical command posts or maybe even operational command posts, depending on what echelon we're talking about. And then at the very least, I can now use the aircraft as flying artillery. This mm-hmm. is what the P-47 for that time frame, modern day A-10, Su-25. That's what allows them to get. So if one side has it and the other side doesn't, what that allows you to the side that has it and the other side doesn't is it allows the side with air power to take chances that ordinarily would not be acceptable. When Patton does his charge across northern France, he's able to leave an entirely open southern flank. There are Germans down there. Mm-hmm. He doesn't care because he knows that the Air Force is basically has his flank. Mm-hmm. And if the Germans try and counterattack, they'll spot it and destroy it rapidly.
Well, and let's put the other hat on. Sorry, we have to make you a Nazi for this. But if you're Captain Nance in his German tank in that same campaign, what problems do you now have?
And that's the fundamental problem, right, is that if the other side's got it, every time I move, yeah. I am subject to observation and possible destruction. Mm-hmm. And, but this is the interesting thing about the 73 war for is that the Israelis have depended upon this, so they've gotten used to taking those risks. But now they're taking those risks without the risk mitigation factor that allowed them to do it. But the Egyptians don't have the air power to take advantage of the fact that the Israelis are pushed off.
Right.
They've made it neutral.
The Arabs have very good A2AD, anti-access area denial, but they do not have their own air forces that could fight the IAF. Right.
Right. They've made it neutral.
That
right.
was actually part of the intelligence fail. Well, the Israelis so assumed, until they could buy that air force, which wasn't going to come online until about 75, that the Egyptians wouldn't go start another war.
So let's talk about the third pillar of this. We've talked tanks, we've talked air. If you are the Arab states and you know the Israelis depend on good intelligence leading to fast reaction, how do you mitigate that? How do you prevent the Israelis from getting the intelligence advantage?
So they have a series of brilliant deception operations. This is classic MILDEC. They do just, I think, close to 30 exercises at the canal. Every time they do it, they leave some forces there after the exercise. So they have the slow force buildup. Something as simple as they have Egyptian soldiers fishing and hanging out at the canal, looking lackadaisical, and just lulling the Israelis, again, who think very little of the Egyptian fighting capability at that time,
because
based on previous performance. And so they lull them into complacency.
Because it's not a surprise that the Egyptians are going to try and plan to cross the canal. Yeah. It's not really a shock to the Israelis that the Egyptians are planning a crossing.
Yeah, they know they want the land. A lot of it, too, is this, a lot of signals are there, but they have this idea called the concept. These are the conditions that have to be met for Egypt to go on offense, including especially the idea of a bomber air force that could attack the interior of Israel. And because they don't have that, the Israeli imagination can't get around the idea of a more limited action based around contesting rather than dominating.
How does an intelligence organization arrive at that point where instead of assessing an enemy's real capabilities and actions, they're basically planning against what they hope or even what they need to happen?
Ask the U.S. Navy at Pearl Harbor. This is very common in warfare. And, I mean, it's difficult anyways to get in the head of your opponent. We're, in my opinion, not any better at it than anyone else. We have many, sometimes we've gotten it right, other times been wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, the Chinese come across the Yalu River, and we didn't think they would. It's happened.
Also, bear in mind that what's the stated political objectives, right? Which is Egypt through the 60s and from the foundation of Israel from 48 forward, Egypt had been trying for the destruction of Israel. Mm-hmm. So if that's the stated political object, you think that all military actions are going to go towards that and maybe not anything less than that.
The other thing is there's actually, Egypt is doing a very good, President Sadat is good at this, information campaign. He publishes news stories saying they're not satisfied with the Soviet equipment. They have some spats with the Soviets publicly. So it's a comprehensive campaign to create this picture, this narrative of unreadiness, mm-hmm. of a military that's not fully recovered from previous defeat, and they, it's spectacular in its success.
So let's again put you both in your respective units on the front. You guys have commanded forces in combat. You're sitting in an Israeli tank, or Israeli unit at the Suez. You see the Egyptians doing all this. You see the guys fishing. You know that the Egyptians are coming at some point, but you're reading all these reports, you're seeing all this stuff happen. So what's happening to you sitting on the Suez for years?
Well, of course, that's difficult duty, routine duty. But at the same time, they are not that far removed from several existential wars. Part of it is they have a war plan they're confident in they misjudge the timing. Basically, they do the timing on it'll take the Egyptians this far to get across. our tanks will beat them to the canal, and we'll be literally, they have gunnery fighting positions on the canal where they're going to shoot boats in the water with tanks, shoot to the other side. Instead, the Egyptians get it done much faster and occupy those positions. And that's why when these tank companies assault, they're moving to where they should be occupying positions, and there's already SAGR teams in those positions. And they just, you know, drive into the a torrent of these missiles. So this is part of the thing, that not only do they misjudge the enemy, their war plan misjudges the enemy. Their mobilization is now kind of inside, the Egyptians are inside their decision cycle for the first 48 hours.
Because bear in mind, as you do this, you have to kind of build a credible enemy plan in order to build your own plan. Mm-hmm. This is what we teach the students here at the college, is that as you're building your plan, the S2, the intelligence officer, basically says, this is how the enemy will fight here, and they lay that out on the map. And then once they lay that out on the map, then the American operations officer will then come through and build any number of courses of action, but he or she's fighting against that particular red plan that's out there, and it's based off of timing, as Carl Jennings said, all this kind of stuff. You have to have that. And bear in mind, they've been there for now 6 years. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, the plan that made sense when you first built it may not make sense, but when do you know when to change it?
And also to the point, even if you do decide to change the plan, are the soldiers ready to execute and prepared for something different?
It's hard to maintain a constant state of readiness in perpetuity. And the other problem, too, is that you don't want all your forces up front, because if everyone's in their defense positions, well, then you've given the enemy a very clear picture to plan off of.
Those Egyptian fishermen are scouting those positions.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, you're right there. So that gives them all the information they need. Mm-hmm. Also, you're more vulnerable, because if they do bring up artillery, you're sitting right there, and you will, and that first 30 seconds to a couple hours is going to be a surprise. However you do it, unless you just get massively lucky, so you want to be back so you're not killed in that first salvo, but then you get forward.
Right. All right, so we finally arrived at the point of the conflict. The setup is really important for this war, but now the shooting has started. So what happens on day one?
Day one, Egyptians and Syrians go on the attack. Really well done. Two corps-sized field armies on the Egyptian side, they come over, a series of bridging operations, and then they overwhelm the string of Israeli forts and then deflect the initial kind of maybe battalion-sized counterattacks by the Israelis. There's a Sinai division. It's an active duty armor division that's permanently stationed in the Sinai. It immediately goes on a counterattack, largely uncoordinated, largely not combined arms, and it loses about 200 of 300 tanks in about maybe a day and a half. Mm-hmm. By lose, damaged, destroyed, some of their tanks are recovered and fixed. And this is, while this is happening, the state of Israel, the people are mobilizing. At the same time, Syria comes over the berm and just almost pushes the Israelis off the Golan Heights. Maybe 1,200 tanks, a couple thousand artillery pieces. And there's some epic moments where you have just a couple tank crews holding the line. Now, this is where that timing thing works in Israel's favor. They mobilize forces up to the Golan a lot faster than the Syrians had thought. So they're inside their decision cycle. Pretty soon, Syrian army, not as effective as the Egyptians, is pushed off the Golan Heights. And instead of stopping there at the pre-war boundary, Israel's just going to push towards Damascus and invade Syria proper. Within a few days, they're shelling Damascus, mm-hmm, with artillery. Not as good a picture in the Sinai. The Egyptians come over, defeat the counterattacks, establish that defense, and then Israel finally muscles up its reserve armor divisions, which are actually its best divisions. It's a little bit opposite of a normal army. This is where you got some big personalities like Ariel Sharon, Bran Adan, and those guys are going to go on their counterattacks, and they will also take a beating. They're still trying to process, what is this new anti-access set they're dealing with, and you know, they're going to lose a lot of tanks in the first 3 days.
So let's take that a step further. So there are, at this point, I don't believe there are any pure tank factories in Israel. That has now changed with the invention of the Merkava. Yeah. However, where are the replacement tanks coming from for Israel? Because it's not just about getting combat power there. It's generating and sustaining combat
power. So, so it's kind of a misnomer that the replacement tanks arrived towards the end of the war and aren't really decisive in the fight. It's the replacement ammunition. What surprises everybody involved, both the combatants, the benefactors, is the consumption rate for class 5, which is ammo. So we're talking tank ammo and artillery ammo. And then some stress on class 3 fuel, but mostly it's the ammo. The tanks are shooting at a rate they did not anticipate. The carnage on the battlefield is epic. And so that, without that resupply, I'm not sure Israel could have gone back on offense. Okay. But America will commence a massive airlift operation to bring in just stockpiles of ammunition and other equipment.
So we've got this first day, as we mentioned, and as you've kind of talked about throughout, the Israeli spearhead has essentially been shattered, right?
Yes.
Their rapid air-supported armor attacks just are not working in the, as you mentioned, they do work in Syria. They don't so much work in the Sinai. So now you've got the Egyptians in a good defensive position on the east side of the canal. You've got the Israelis trying to figure out how to deal with them. As you mentioned, the counterattacks are kind of piecemeal and fail. So what happens now?
This is where you got about 3 Israeli divisions online, and they have to go into a defense, and they're dueling with the Egyptians as they reconstitute. So one of the themes I like to bring out is this idea of large formation reconstitution, something the U.S. Army hasn't dealt with probably since Korea-ish. And so literally they're not allowed to pull out of the line like some World War I division and reform, they have to continue fighting while they receive replacements, repair, rebuild tanks, kind of war game new tactics. And all the while they're looking these soldiers in the eye, and you're going back into the teeth of that SAG or defense. So that's really the next week they're going to spend doing that. They know, so remember, Israel, smaller nation, has to win decisively. They can't do a long attritional war. They know they lose. They got to restore maneuver and decision to the battlefield. For them, what they know, that means crossing the canal and defeating the Egyptians in Africa. That's how you end the war on your terms. And they have a problem. There's two Egyptian reserve armor divisions that are on the west side of the canal. And as long as those are over there, any gap crossing is bound to fail. So imagine you get across the river, you got your lodgment, you're going to get hit by those big armor divisions when you're at your weakest. And that's where they're kind of holding, they're rebuilding, and then Sadat will oblige them with that political mandate to save Syria by attacking further in the Sinai.
So let's dive into the details here. Conceptual. And that is the idea of what the military today calls a gap crossing, right?
Yep.
The Suez is it's an artificial canal, but it's a decent sized waterway. Why is that such a problem for large modern military formations?
Most tanks don't swim. Some do, but most don't. And so you're at your most vulnerable during the crossing, the mechanisms of the crossing itself, so the bridges, the forces guarding the crossing are fixed in a place, as well as the bridgehead on the other side. As you try to build combat power to do something to break out, to hold ground. And so it's one of the hardest combined arms operations that an army can do. That's why when the U.S. Army trains, it's one of the primary training tasks at division and corps level. Is a gap crossing, because if you can do that, you can do a lot of other things. The synchronization required, the practice, the integration of fire and maneuver, intelligence. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's always been one of the hardest tasks the military can do.
And it's not just tanks that don't swim, it's the trucks that carry all the stuff that you want.
That's right.
None of those
and
that
so
are to my knowledge.
What we're seeing in Ukraine, having an assured causeway in a age of ubiquitous fires, transparent battlefield is very tough. So the Israelis figure it out. They figure out there's a fortuitous gap between the second and third Egyptian armies. And again, they're waiting for that trigger. As long as those two armored divisions are on the other side, they can't do much. Those divisions cross and lead the Egyptian assault into the central Sinai and are shattered. Once that happens, the conditions are set for an Israeli crossing. Ariel Sharon with the 143rd Division will lead that effort. And, you know, they get it done through a sequencing of four types of crossing mechanisms. You have rubber boats for the initial crossing. You have motorized rafts that get the first 20 tanks across. That's important. I'll come back to that. You're going to bring up a sectional pontoon bridge, which will take enormous fire and be down to its last replacement section by the end. And then finally, they have a 400-ton roller bridge. It's just a giant cast iron bridge that they're going to drag up, push across the canal with tanks, and it's almost indestructible. And so they need that, the sequencing. Without all four of those, it doesn't happen. Most of the rafts are taken out of action by it because very quickly the Egyptians figure out what's happening and start, they have an entire artillery brigade just launching fires. They have aerial fires. They have kamikaze helicopters by the myth of the story. And so it's a wild time. Dozens of Israeli engineers die there. Many are wounded. At least a dozen tanks will fall into the canal because they're hit with artillery while crossing. So this is dangerous, but they're pushing through. And let me get back, the 20 tanks that are rafted across. This is what I call the decisive moment of the campaign. Instead of going into a defensive posture to secure the lodgment, you know, most people would expect a counterattack or to get bombed. They break out and they start raiding the proximate SAMS batteries. And this is crucial. They tear a hole in the integrated air defense shield right at the center of the line and allow the Israeli air to get back in the fight. And this is the beginning of restoring that air-ground approach that is essential for maneuver.
So let's talk about this, as you call it, the crucial point, both from a conceptual and from a practical standpoint. Captain Nance, you're in your tank. You get across this lodgment as one of these, and into this lodgment as one of these 20 tanks. For you, doctrinally, what's your next task?
Couple things. One is that typically you're gonna once you seize the foothold, then you then try and retain the foothold. So you're gonna expand the lodgment, build combat power, get to a certain strength, and start rolling out. As what's interesting, what Colonel Jennings pointed out is that the Israeli armor force actually did something not expected. That is not the... If you pull open a manual, it doesn't say go find the nearest air defense network and blow it up.
Right.
In small teams. Two to three tank teams just darting out.
Why is that not recommended?
Because what ends up happening is once you're across, who's ever across is whatever's across. And if you got 20 tanks, that's great. You don't have ammunition. You don't have any more ammunition because that has to come ashore by raft. You don't have any more fuel. That has to come ashore by some other means. And if the enemy hit, and infantrymen are great, infantrymen are wonderful, infantrymen will lose in a stand-up fight against an enemy armor force. So you want to keep that armor there to protect your foothold as long as possible. So the idea that these guys are going out raiding is they're taking a major gamble, because if there is something as simple as an unaccounted for Egyptian battalion, or heck, even a company of tanks comes rolling up out of the night and hits that bridgehead, and all that's there are a couple intrepid Israeli paratroopers, you're gonna lose. They will fight well and they will fight hard, but they will lose. So that's a major risk.
And you might ask, why only 20 tanks? Because the Israeli theater commander orders Sharon to stop sending tanks across until the big bridges can come up. Because until you can have assured access, it's a liability, actually. Mm-hmm. They've already lost a lot of tanks. They can't afford to have, you know, a whole brigade stranded on the other side. And so it turns into a very caustic debate where Sharon sees the opening, wants to break out, wants to move his whole division across. By the way, the Battle of the Chinese Farm, which is basically there's a huge battle that takes place along the access route to the canal from the Israeli side. Another intel fail. They don't realize the Egyptians are on the route. and you got to push them back to be able to move the bridges through. Sharon is not fully aware, I believe, on how vulnerable the bridge convoys are. He wants to push out, so differing risk assessment between the division commander, whose boots are in the water, and the theater commander, who has a wider perspective. And so they say, halt the just 20 tanks, no more, till we get the big bridges up, make sure this thing's going to happen. And so that's where the decision is made. It's actually kind of an interesting anecdote where the tank commander, I think he's a brigade commander on the other side of the canal, gets a call from the Israeli chief of the Air Force. He says, go kill those SAMs batteries now. So you have some air-ground integration at the highest level there. That's a pivot point in the campaign where the Israelis will begin to restore that joint approach and set conditions for the breakout.
So as you mentioned, we've had this ill-fated Egyptian attack into the Sinai. The Israelis are now countering it. So where do we go from here? How do we bring this to a conclusion?
Once the Israeli air can get in the fight through this window of opportunity, multi-domain operations term, it allows the Israelis to establish the pontoon bridge, the big roller bridge, and then bring over two additional divisions. And basically the concept becomes one of maneuver to isolate the two Egyptian field armies that are going to be stranded on the east side of the canal. So the Israeli Air Force will bomb their bridges, and the idea is that Israeli armor will then maneuver north and south from the crossing point at the center and sever the lines of communication of these Egyptian forces all the way back to Cairo National Support Area. They achieve that in the south. The 3rd Egyptian Army will be completely isolated. The IDF will drive all the way down to Suez. By the way, they'll have a disaster in that city. It won't derail the larger operational picture, but they're going to lose more than 80 guys in an ill-advised rush into the city. But nevertheless, Egyptian Third Army is basically held hostage at that point. It's days away from starvation and crumbling. In the north, Ariel Sharon's task of isolating the 2nd Field Army will not happen. He'll get bogged down in front of Ismailia. Nevertheless, Israel basically has fire control over the locks of that field army. Because remember, in the first days of the war, the Israeli Navy shatters the Egyptian Navy and has complete control over the coastline. In fact, there's an O plan to do a Mediterranean envelopment with if the canal crossing wasn't going to work.
So what stops this war then? Is it the Egyptians suing for peace? Is it the Israelis stopping of their own accord? What makes this stop?
It's the Russians and the Americans getting involved, and the UN saying this has to end. Neither side, now the Russians especially, want to see their client state totally defeated. Mm-hmm. They threaten to get involved. The U.S. muscles up with some additional naval assets in the East Med. And so there'll be a couple ceasefires agreed upon at the UN. Kissinger's doing his shuttle diplomacy. And Israel will break those a couple times to get down to the canal. They're fighting against time as increasing world pressure is settling in. What the Soviets don't want, and what Cairo, of course, doesn't want, is a surrender of an entire Egyptian field army.
Mm-hmm. So
the Syrians are just defeated at this point. By the way, the Iraqis get in the game. They're defeated on the Golan front. The Jordanians get in the game. They're defeated. And there's some other, I think the Saudis send some contingents, the Moroccans. So the Israeli, the IDF is having success on all fronts at this point.
And the risk here, it's worth pointing out, the geopolitical risk is, yes, Israel is always in a position of being threatened, but on the other hand, a lot of the world powers do not want the Israelis controlling the Suez Canal, which is a big geopolitical
risk. And the Suez Canal has been closed to all traffic since 1967.
Right.
So, I want to take you back to something. So, in the summer of 2000, a long time ago, I got to go to Cairo, and we went to the Egyptian War Museum. And part of the Egyptian War Museum is the Victory of 73 Panorama. Mm-hmm. So, talk me through how, because we just went through the narrative, and it sounds like two Egyptian armies basically almost captured, pulled out by the Soviets. How do the Egyptians square that ending of the war with a victory of 1973?
Well, this is where I'll give credit to Sadat, a masterpiece of strategic narrative manipulation. He pitches that because they bloodied the vaunted Israeli war machine, because they took ground away from them, they're still holding the West Bank when the war ends. He calls it a win, and he's able to bring that home to his people.
Of the West Bank of the Sinai, or of the Suez Canal.
That's right. Unlike the Syrians who just lose, Sadat is able to claim some measure of victory here. In fact, they'll do reenactments of it and holidays, and he'll decorate everyone except his chief of staff, who he basically fires over disagreements about the assault into the Sinai. And so, you know, he probably finds a ready and willing audience in some parts of the world to accept that narrative of a Egyptian victory. And so what you'll end up with, basically, a lot of winners here, and Syria is the big loser.
So let's talk about exactly what the settlement is and the effects are, because this is a hugely consequential war. What does it mean for each of the belligerents? What's the end result by, let's say, 1980?
Yeah, so what Israel wants is to have recognition, to have peace. Because even though they were successful in some of their wars, this idea of living on a hair trigger for national mobilization is just not viable. Mm-hmm. That's part of the problem with 73, by the way. They have a couple aborted mobilizations that wreck their economy every time over the previous year. Mm-hmm. And so they're slow, they're hesitant to trigger that if it's not a real war about to happen. A lot of interesting parallels with the Germans and others leading to World War I with rail mobilization timetables. Mm-hmm. But so what they're going to get is recognition, and they're going to trade basically depth for assurance. Egypt will recognize the state of Israel. They'll have some deals, the accords at Camp David, mm-hmm. and you'll have a UN force there for assurance. And really, it's the start of, I would say, secures Israel's southern flank. Also, the Egyptians will align with the Americans for equipment, for economic relations, for some financial assistance. And so that's going to also really kind of put a bow on the deal.
What about the northern Arab states, particularly the Jordanians and Syrians?
Yeah, the Jordanians are interesting. There's some feel that their king didn't really want to get in the war. He warns the Israelis before the war that their Arabs are about to attack. He gives in to pressure from his officer corps and launches a assault at the end. I would say somewhat half-hearted. So he'll come out of this actually, and they'll end up in a fairly stable alliance with Israel. The Syrians are the ones who will be bitter and get almost nothing. They get a village on the very, the West Bank of the Golan Heights. Israel eventually will have some kind of treaty with them, but it's not. It's not the same.
And so the Syrians will fight, and the Syrians will end up fighting the Israelis again in Lebanon.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And we have something very interesting happen in regional politics, which is essentially, I don't know that this is the death of Pan-Arabism, but as you mentioned, the Egyptian-Syrian enmity is not good for that movement. But also the Egyptian recognition of Israel is really a nail in the coffin of mm-hmm. that movement for reasons that are
and then the final nail will be the alignment 20 years later of Saudi with the U.S.
Right. So this is in many ways a turning point in regional politics. It's also a turning point in international politics, because this is the single most significant trigger for the OPEC embargo. Mm-hmm. With the U.S. helping Israel, then OPEC really ramps up its organization and its pressure, and that leads to a worldwide economic downturn in the 70s, right? We don't need to go into that, but it's part of the effect. What I do want to talk about, and for both of you as historians and practitioners, are the military effects of this war. So the world is watching this war. they're watching the IDF get bloody, really for the first time in a significant way. So what does this mean for the militaries watching, particularly the United States military watching this war?
Well, I mean, we have our own problem that's similar to the Israelis, right? Which is we are facing a large opponent that outnumbers us across a hostile border, in this case, the inter-German border. Mm-hmm. And the idea that can you hold conventionally against a large hostile force,
the Soviets,
with minimal warning. Mm-hmm. And the answer really up until that point had been kind of, well, probably, but we're probably going to end up using nukes. That was kind of the expectation throughout the 50s and the 60s, is at some point the ground forces are going to request the release of nuclear weapons, and it's going to happen.
And we should note, we are not talking about using nuclear weapons on enemy cities. We're talking about using tactical nuclear weapons.
Right. And then, of course, the nuclear theorists say, well, where does you got the escalation ladder. It's like, does that stop with just obliterating divisions, or does it lead to cities? But we come through the end of this, and to quote great cinema of the modern era, so you're saying there's a chance.
Right.
And that fundamentally transforms American doctrine. One of my pet hobby words is I think it transforms American doctrine from American doctrine to very German doctrine. We go from a large, okay army to a smaller, excellent army. And with the idea of a rapid, clean, quick win, clean might be the wrong term to use, but a rapid win, rapid decisive win, whatever that might mean.
Clean compared to, say, Korea, where it's just an attritional slugfest.
Right.
Yeah.
And if we go back to what shocked everyone about this war was the consumption, the how much ammo they went through of artillery, tanks, and then the sheer carnage and destruction on this mechanized battlefield. Everyone realizes that we can't. If that happens in Europe, we lose. We don't have enough, so you can either try to have a quantitative parity with the Soviets. We can't do that, so we're going to go qualitative. And it's doctrine. It's also we need a better kit, so it's going to catalyze a acquisitions program, a series of them to produce a better tank, better aircraft, better artillery, better everything. Because if we're going to fight outnumbered, we need to have that edge on quality. And then finally, I'll mention better people. At the same time, right, in the background, we have the withdrawal from Vietnam. Transition to the all-volunteer force isn't just about excising the demons of Vietnam. It's also we need a better soldier that, every one of our soldiers has to defeat three Russian soldiers. Mm-hmm. And so better people in this better equipment with a new doctrine designed to win quickly and decisively.
Let's talk about the kind of the technical details and really where we started. An observer might look at this war and say the lessons are obvious. Sagar beats tank, IADS beats plane. So first of all, is that correct? And then why or why not?
Well, it's not correct because the Israelis defeat all of those by the end. It's just a lesson that you have to have a joint approach. You have to have a combined arms approach. You have to think this through. And I think that's the lesson. It's about understanding echelonment, which is one of the big problems in Europe. So I think I wouldn't say that. It's more of just, a sobering realization that this isn't going to be cost-free. Remember, General Starry has the famous quote, what can be seen can be killed. So it's an idea that the tanks will still be the centerpiece of the order of battle, but they're going to have to maneuver. They're going to have to use terrain. They're going to have to use a combined arms approach at different times with different packages in order to succeed. That you're not just going to charge up with your main battle tank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Dr. Jennings hit a large part of it already, but the idea is that we keep on saying, well, this is the end of this. This is the end of that. And sometimes, yes. We don't see large mounted horse cavalry running around anymore.
Much to the two cavalry officers' chagrin.
Much to my chagrin, yeah. But the idea being is that for every piece of technology that's been superseded, it's generally brought with it a different change that allows you to have the same effect. Mass mounted maneuver is still a thing. We just don't ride horses anymore. We ride vehicles because it's more efficient.
They take less hay.
Exactly. But what it comes out to is that the idea of like, it's not necessarily about your kit, it's about how you use the kit. Again, remember, 1956, 1967, even in 73, the Israelis are using not the absolute top of the line equipment that's available. Mm-hmm. There you now towards the end of the war, we start giving them TOW missiles, we start giving them later model M60s. These are all things that are going to come about, but for the most part, the 73 war is not fought with the top of the line. It's fought with kind of the second or the third echelon below it, and particularly as you start to take tank casualties, you grab whatever tank you happen to have available. So this idea, so it's not just about what you have, but how you use it. You look at the Ukraine war. They're using stuff that we were planning to fight back in the 80s. Now, sometimes it's been upgraded, sometimes it's been, but the idea is that it's how you use this equipment, and then also how do you stay in the fight? Because it's great if you've got the wonder weapon, but what happens when you can only make 10 of them? And that's it. Eventually, you will lose.
Right. This is the Nazi problem late in World War II, right? It's great they can build Tiger tanks, but if they can only build 100, so what?
Yeah, attrition is the Achilles heel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this has been a fascinating discussion of a conflict in which a lot of the major belligerents all won, oddly enough, with the great exception of the Syrians. So, Colonel Jennings, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.